Welcome to The Running Public with Bracken Crocker and Kirk DeWint.
Whether you are a brand new runner or you already have a great mustache,
we're here to help you increase your running knowledge and present it at a practical level. This is The Running Public. When you're ready to take your training or racing to the next level, go to therunningpublic.com. We have both monthly subscription training plans, $19.99 a month, and Bracken and I both offer one-on-one customized coaching. Again, go to therunningpublic.com and check out our offerings.
Just before we hit record, we were talking about my communication styles digitally. Mm-hmm. And in the words of Ross Wehmer, I'm the best worst communicator he knows. If I'm in front of you, I communicate well. If I'm not, good luck kind of thing. But in spirit of this Q&A, I checked our Running Public inbox this week.
Oh, okay.
Went through the red messages, the seen messages, to just make sure that I was on top of Q&A questions. Didn't really like read them or study them, but just to see if more were coming in or any redundant ones that I had on my end. And I saw a message in there that warmed my heart. Can you guess what it was?
How recent was it?
This week. Since we released Training Tuesday.
Oh, it was a message about somebody hurting their knee in bed.
The exact same word-for-word story as how I injured my knee. Side sleeping in a sleep twitch. And we both felt justified by the other person sharing an experience that no one else believed actually happened like that.
It's a beautiful thing. I guess you could. I could see it. Either a sleep twitch or the way you're lying on your side, laying on your side. Mm-hmm. And even if you just moved without a twitch in the wrong manner, there's a lot of torque on the knee potentially. So I could make sense of it, but to have somebody else with the exact same story, unbelievable.
It just made me feel good that because I still feel crazy saying it.
You know what's interesting about your Running Public Instagram message habit is I opened it up many times a day now. It's primarily me on there, but once in a while I'll go in and be like, I didn't respond to that, and I see some you did, but it's rare. But yesterday I went in and we had three messages at the time I opened it up, but the middle message was opened already and I think liked or something. So you opened our Instagram messages, saw there were three in there, just picked one, opened it, saw what they said, liked it, and they're like, nope. the other two, you're like, I'm not going to open those. do you recall what I'm talking about there? And I opened it, I was like, this makes no sense. Like, what's your process?
As I was swiping through notifications, getting them off my phone, I accidentally opened that one. And usually I'll just click unread, but it was something that could be handled with an emoji, so I just liked it or laughed or something and then moved out.
I was like,
there was no rhyme or reason. It was just an accident. I didn't belong in that inbox.
Oh, I was just like, you just pick and choose. Like, you just look at it and then be like, that one, yeah, I can do that. But that one, I'm not even touching
that. That'd
be
psychotic.
Okay. Anyways, I don't want to detract from your story.
Yeah.
Unless you're done.
It was a message from a female listener, correct? Or athlete?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That was an accidental thumb swipe. Mm.
I was telling you before we hit record here that One of the athletes I coach, Chad Coleman, who is also a guest on our podcast. We had a very raw conversation with Chad Coleman maybe about a year ago. Anyways, he sent me a video about a half an hour ago of his impressions of some of us podcast folk running. Rich Ryan, you, myself, and Hunter. And it's oddly accurate and sort of amusing. And I'm wondering, do you think I should post it to the Running Public Instagram page and see if they agree? If it is us?
Absolutely.
All right. Don't be offended if your form is the sloppiest in his impression. You have to be ready for that.
I'm not a pretty runner, and I'll never claim to be. I have a very unique style. A little stiff, a little jerky. It cleans up the faster I get, but I'll never claim to be a pretty strider.
I'm the same way. Forward lean, letting gravity do the work. The only pretty one out of the four is Rich Ryan. He prances like a pony. Other than him...
And even he's almost too vertical. I don't like it. It's too effortless.
He's not as vertical, and we'll get into this episode in a second. There's a guy at the gym that I train at who his stride is the middle ground between high knees and a regular running stride, to the point of like when I first saw him, I'm like, he must be doing drills on the treadmill. well, a half an hour later, he's still doing the same thing and he's running so slow. Like I can tell he's working hard and it's like he's going up and down more than he's going forward. And I can't decide if it's in my right to go talk to him. I've never spoken to him. He just does his thing and leaves. And I don't know how to approach it, but I want to help. What do you do in that situation?
I almost just never involve myself.
But is it our duty?
It's so hard to come off the right way.
Is it our duty to, in that circumstance, to help?
No. I think no. If you were maybe training for something or injured or frustrated looking, that's the open door. But I think there needs to be a door open. If he's just exercising, just making it tougher on himself. Just getting a good workout.
You're not wrong.
For me, I'm a non-invasive gym goer.
Okay. Well, that's my profession too. But from the eye test, he's a fit guy, meaning like he looks like he takes care of himself and prides himself. And maybe he's onto some trendy method that I'm not aware of that burns like 15 times more calories. I have no idea what his intentions are. You're right. I'll just go ask him. I'll just be passive aggressive about it. I'll just, hey man, I see you on the treadmill, good. But what are you doing here? What are you training for? What's going on? And then I'll work my way in over the weeks, maybe slowly.
I get a minimum of one comment or direct message every time I post any sort of footage of me running, of someone critiquing either my cadence or my arm carriage. Every single time.
Mind your own damn business, folks. What do they say?
And they might be right. But like, what am I going to do at this point? It's not like I'm a few tenths away from a qualification standard for something. You're going to lower my 5K by 90 seconds by fixing my arm carriage.
Po buddies nerfed, as they say. But what do they say about your arm carriage?
That's exactly right. A little lower. It's what one person was saying, I'm driving it forward or backwards faster than the other direction. I either accelerate it backwards faster than forward or forward faster than backward. And I don't even know if that's possible in a running stride. I have a little bit of circle with my hand while my arms stay low, and it just looks a little weird. And my running cadence is a little low. But I get a message every single time. And so probably because of that, I just have no interest in inserting myself into other people's stride.
Okay. Well, you convinced me then. And I'm feeling myself getting a little defensive for
you. You should.
For you. And that's the answer right there. Like, if I'm getting defensive on your behalf, if I go approach a gentleman at the gym who I believe needs help, most likely will come off the wrong way, even if I use as much charm as
that.
I possibly have, which isn't much.
It could be as simple as, hey, I see you running a lot. That's my profession. If you're ever interested in chatting about it or advice, let me know. And if they're like, yeah, thank God, because I feel like I'm high-stepping, then you're in. And if he's like, nope, I've got it locked down.
I'm going to befriend him, and then I'm going to trick him into fixing it. That's what I'm going to do. Just little comments here and there, and eventually,
yeah,
he's a four-minute miler. Anything else we need to waste time with here before we jump into today?
I did a ramp test this morning on the treadmill.
Okay. Tell people what that is, actually. That would be a good talking point. A ramp test. What is a ramp test, Bracken?
I believe it originated with cycling on a bike, going up wattage every, I don't know, sometimes they do a minute, sometimes they do two, but hit a higher wattage every minute or two until you can't sustain. And it tells you either your critical power or your functional threshold power. Doesn't really matter which one, but it gives you training zones basically based on your power. Well, for running, they do a version of that essentially for VO2 max testing.
Yeah, kind of. You'll get that with like a stress test at the hospital, sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Same kind of thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's essentially the same thing. I just put it to 10% incline and started at 4 miles per hour and just went up 0.2 every 2 minutes. Well, first I did a warm up and then 0.2 every 2 minutes till it was unsustainable. And along the way, noted the breathing inflection points for aerobic threshold and lactate threshold and noted those verbally to my phone as my heart rate monitor was going and double checking that with what my pre-established aerobic and anaerobic threshold heart rates are. And they correlated just about perfectly, but I got my current paces at those as well. And so I'm kicking off a long training block here, and I like to start with a little bit of testing, but I did not want to start with a 5K time trial or anything like that because I'm not in the mood to do that.
You don't hate yourself enough to do that at this moment in your life.
No, and I'm not confident enough either. It's got to be one or the other.
The key to the ramp test versus, like, I'll prescribe progression. Like, we'll do an incline progression run, but we'll up it 0.1 miles per hour every 5 minutes, right? Which is too slow. For a ramp test, mm-hmm. you want to get right to work, right? You want to be like a minute or two, like, this thing's going to end in 15 minutes-ish or whatever, you know, pretty quick. Like, I want to find my critical velocity or whatever you want to call it. Like, pretty quick. You don't want to wear yourself out via, like, engine work. You want to just get right to the good stuff. Hence, 0.2 every 2 minutes. That's a really quick ramp up, and it's over. How long did it take you, I guess, out of curiosity? Yeah. 15 minutes?
Whole thing was 20 minutes.
20 minutes.
Right? Something yeah. right around there, yeah.
Yeah. They're short, sweet, stingy, but they're very measurable.
Very. And then if I ever go up more than, like, 3 or 4 beats per minute on any one, then I hold for an extra minute or two to let it stabilize before going up. Just to make sure. And I didn't come up with that. That's some protocol listed on other tests. But every once in a while, you get a little fluctuation at a new stride and then it settles back down in. There are a few times, like, I bumped up over 150, like 2 or 3 times, and then settled back to like 148, 149. So just to confirm that I'm not pulling the plug too early on any one zone. Mm. But it's a good test. It's something I recommend people doing.
Well, it's actually, as far as a fitness test, I like that a lot more sometimes than even like a 15-15 challenge, which is like 15 minutes at 15%, cover as much distance as you can. Well, yeah. You got to get it right out of the gates or you don't, and then you play with the speed. Whereas, like, I guess you'd call it a critical velocity test or a ramp test. It's like every time you ease into it and you end up, you could run to failure where you literally can't sustain it anymore, and you'll get a time marker or a speed marker, which you made it to. And that's going to be consistent. Like, that'll be a true test versus the 15-15, which is, I think, very tricky to execute correctly and get everything out of you. A ramp test is going to, you're going to find out the right answer every time, if that makes sense.
Good day, bad day, mediocre day, you're going to get your aerobic and lactate threshold every time. Because hitting lactate threshold within like 18 minutes is not that challenging. If it's truly the pace you can keep for 45 to 60 minutes or so. Like, it's not hard to do. So even if you're off or you're fatigued or whatever, you're still going to get there. It's just how long past that do you want to go?
Right.
And on a bad day, once you establish it and you go one notch past and establish that I certainly am over, you can end it and get all the data you'll ever need for a training block. It's, if you want to make it a time trial, then you can run yourself into the ground if you really want to. But there's no, you can't get it wrong technically. You just follow every 2 minutes it goes up. And there's no poor pacing.
Bada bing, bada boom.
So you're exactly right.
Okay. Well, and what did, I guess, did the test tell you you're in shape or not?
The last few weeks have eroded the confidence that I was in shape. But prior to that, it's easy to forget that I was moving in a good place. So the test was a good reminder that, yeah, you're rusty right now, but you haven't lost really much fitness. So it was a good reminder. I'm in decent fitness right now. And I'm in the right kind of fitness to improve quickly with a sustained block. Like, I don't want to race right now, but a few good weeks of training and I'm going to start to want to race again. So it was a good reminder.
Slowish fast is what I believe you've labeled yourself
slowish
as today.
Fast. That's a good description.
Yeah. Well, you came up with it, so I assumed you would approve. All right. That's enough of this. We have a Q&A today, folks. This dates back to March 16th would be the longest ago question, which is really good for us. That is 40 days ago or something, which is pretty good. So a little pat on the back. We haven't let them pile up too much. I think I have, let's see here. I have 16 saved. And looking at them come through, there was a number that I was sort of excited to get to, like an angle we haven't been asked about something or just some well thought out questions. I don't know if you've noticed this, Bracken, but as we progress now, we're going to hit year four, I guess, 4 full years plus of this. The questions get like more layered, more in the weeds, more in depth, more hair splitting. And I feel like a number of these are that way, which just shows like what a mature audience we have now.
And in that realm only.
What does that mean?
Only in training questions. I feel like we have a perfectly immature audience most of the time.
Right. Our requests for
I appreciate
run poop story episodes still come in. So that's that.
Yeah. Outrageous.
All right. Well, why don't we just
all be ashamed of yourselves at things I've heard you do.
And I don't really want to ask for submissions for that one because we'll get a lot of them and they'll probably be detailed and I'll have to like screenshot those and keep them in my phone. And that's another thing I don't want to have to deal with. Just a poop stories folder. Like I never thought I'd see the day. Let's get to this thing. How's that sound?
Kick it off.
All right. Dave Shaw. Dave Shaw says, hey guys, Q&A topic idea. Apologies if you've covered it before. How would you train for obstacles if you don't have access to local training centers? Example, ninja centers, bouldering, etc. Assuming you do have access to trails and hills for runs and monkey bars in local parks. Big love to the running public. That's the question.
Now, it was a different era. Obviously, it was a full decade ago. More, it was 12 years ago. But I trained for and podiumed at my first Spartan Race World Championship without access to a single obstacle. I did two Tough Mudders and one Spartan Race along the way, and maybe like a Dirty Dog mud run. So four times I touched obstacles in 26 weeks, and the rest was all done on, most of it was done on soccer goalposts. Mm. And then occasionally a monkey bar. All the rest was carries and crawls and burpees and lunges and jumping lunges. But I believe that with a monkey bar, you're set. You can do pull-ups. You can do grip switches. You can do single arm swinging and hanging. You can torque everything in every way it needs to be torqued. And then for getting over walls, you just do muscle-ups or kippy muscle-ups and get up over the monkey bars. That's what I was doing on the goalposts, or traversing down it sideways or backwards. You can get 90% of the way there, and then you use baseball fences or softball fences for walls as well, and you're set.
Mm. I think a lot of people run into this situation, or they just don't want to. Mm. Like, going to the ninja gym's inconvenient. It's a bunch of screaming, snotty kids until 9 p.m. when the open gym is, and you don't want to go then. Like, people fall into that camp too, right? So I think all you need, I mean, my entire career, I didn't really step foot in an obstacle gym. I just used the pull-up bar at the gym. You can do grip switches, swinging back and forth, your pull-ups. I think you need to focus on two things. You need to mess your legs up and then run, and you need to do stuff overhead and then run. It's as simple as that. So you can mess your legs up anywhere, jump squats, jump lunges, burpee broad jumps, tuck jumps, all those things. No problem. That can be done anywhere at any time. And then all you need is something to put your hands on overhead. One simple bar, monkey bars would be great, but you can do your muscle-ups, assisted muscle-ups, again, hip tap, dead hangs, the grip switches, which would be like over, over, under, under, back and forth, or going back and forth along the same bar. That's it. You don't need a ninja gym at all, unless your proprioception, i.e. your awareness of your body in space, is terrible, and you literally need to get on the actual obstacles. For an athlete like Bracken, who's a lateral ball sport athlete, like intuitively, you can get across anything because you move like an athlete. Not everybody does. And if you're that person who's like, I'm not coordinated, I need to get on the real thing, then yeah, you're going to have to go to open gym and go figure it out. But if you're like Bracken and myself as well, like, I don't need to, I can get on it and instinctively manage. So that's my thought. Mm-hmm. Thoughts.
Yeah. If you're athletic and good at moving through space, hand-eye coordination and just body coordination, I think you could be comfortable training all the way up to OCR World Championships without an obstacle gym. I really do. If you are clumsy, if you are not very skilled with your hands and your eyes, or if you are overweight and the actual grip strength is an issue and you need every tip and trick and repetition to get through these things, then yeah, you should probably get there. But it's low down my list for how to train for OCR. That being said, I don't think either of us would ever be mistaken for the smoothest, fastest obstaclers in the sport. And so if it's the difference between, you know, those 10, 20 seconds throughout a race are costing you your goal, then it's worth doing. But yep, most people aren't 20 seconds away from their goal. So that's where I stand.
That was the caveat I was going to add. Like, yes, I think at OCR World Championship 3K, being well-versed on that specific, those right, specific apparatus. Like, if you could save 15 seconds in a 3K, that's absolutely worth getting very, very specific for. If it's a monkey bars at Spartan Race, you work your grip strength and your ability to swing, and you're splitting hairs at that point.
Right. If you want to beat VJ, or Ida at a 3K. Yeah, you're going to need to do that.
Yep.
But outside of those type of situations, grip strength and just fatigued grip moving your hands is going to get you through everything.
Yep. All right. Next one. Oh. Aaron Leanne something, it's cut off, asks, question mostly from Kirk. On the Q&A interval training episode, you briefly mentioned that you were more and more on the fence about cadence the more you dug into it. Since it was an interval style Q&A, that was all you said about it, and it was one of those times I was dying for you guys to go down the rabbit hole. I've seriously struggled with getting my cadence up. I hired Richard Diaz for a gait analysis and VO2 max test a few years back, and for about 6 months after that, I was able to get my cadence up to 180. But I ended up with a stress fracture, unrelated to cadence, a while after, and then had a bout of COVID and never managed to get my cadence back up. Running with a metronome and an alert on my watch doesn't help. It just makes me angry that I can't turn over that quickly. Really interested in your thoughts on cadence.
Well, she requested you, and she should get you.
What, you're looking
at? I get to play cleanup this time.
All right.
I'm looking what?
Well, you're looking at your phone for something, so you're preparing yourself. I don't know what it's for.
Yeah, I'm pulling up some of my cadences from races.
Oh, okay.
Just so we can chat about that.
So I know, God, the cadence horse was beaten to death for, I feel like 5 years ago to 3 years ago was like the sweet spot, right? It like surfaced up, cadence, cadence, cadence. Now I don't hear much about it again. Do you agree with that? Like, I haven't heard, like, there hasn't been a cadence hype as of recent, and there was previously.
Yep.
So where does 180 come from? Originally, let's back the train up. Cadence comes from a study of what I believe was the World Championships or the Olympics. The top performing, like 10,000 meter runners or 5,000 meter runners, they or marathoners. They looked at the
average 15 and marathon, I believe.
Yeah, they looked at their cadence of the top performers, and the average or right around was roughly 180 strides per minute. And the thought was, well, there's many thoughts with cadence, but it was, well, if the best in the world are racing roughly at 180 strides per minute, there has to be something to it from an efficiency standpoint. So let's start there. That's how it originated. I'm not mistaken with that, correct?
Yep.
It was done in the 80s?
100% accurate.
70s, 80s? I forget when it was done.
I think it was even later. It might have been 90s.
Might have been 90s. So it started there. From there, then it progressed like, all right, well, cadence. If you have a slow cadence, you're probably reaching too far with your stride, causing a braking effect, which is inefficient and also makes you more prone to injury because of the recoil back through your legs, up into your body, through your chain, which is also detrimental on the injury front. Those are the thoughts. So that's just like a brief history lesson. My thoughts on this is that the general population who listens to this isn't built like the average Olympic distance runner, whether it's height, leg to torso ratio, weight, biomechanics alone, just like the way your structure works compared to somebody who's naturally moving through space faster than you. And I think 180 is an arbitrary number that's been slapped at the wall and everybody goes back to it for I don't even know what reason anymore. I think there's a big case for you to increase your cadence if you're struggling with injury. There's a good chance you're overstriding, causing a lot of damage through your system because of the impact. But I think 180 is the most arbitrary number that could have been thrown out there for the masses. And if you're not struggling with injury, you're probably close to your optimal cadence. And if you feel like you're somewhat efficient, you're probably close to your optimal cadence for you. I find 95% of the people are lower than 180. Heck, some of the best runners I know run in the 160s, upper 160s, and race in the lower 170s.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'll just, that's my starting point for you. So now I want to hear what you have to say.
Well, I agree with everything that you've said. Kirk and I have been very clear on here. We're not huge form people in that we don't believe in form overhaul. We believe in form optimization. The human body is just not a template. And since every single pelvis has a different, slightly different tilt to everyone else's, and the width of it is slightly different, and your femur length, and everything about your legs are going to be slightly different, and your legs are going to be slightly longer, shorter than each other, and just anterior tilt is going to be a little different. everyone's slightly different, so I just do not believe we should force the machine to work in the exact same path and pattern as everyone else. This is not robotics, and I think we need to get away from that. The people who that is their thing, she referenced Richard Diaz, there are people like that who that is their thing. So I won't trash their thing. But I will say that if anything was the golden ticket, everyone would be doing it. And there are far too many Olympic and pro runners who run differently and get worse when they get fixed. And so I always look to the top to see what the template is supposed to be, and you don't see a template. Even amongst the pretty gliding runners, they all do it differently. And so I'm just not on board with that. Secondly, this is just a sample size of one, and I am not the world's greatest runner.
Well, I think you carry your arms just a little low when you run, and I think, you know, there's areas of improvement.
Yep.
Yeah.
You are correct, Kirk.
Yeah.
And on the spectrum of runners, from slow to fast, I'm on the faster end of the spectrum. I'm not fast compared to the people faster than me, but I'm fast compared to the people that are slower than me, and there's more people slower than me than faster than me. That's the least egotistical way I can place myself. I would be considered worldwide in the top 1%. As you would.
You're 99 percentile. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We ran collegiately. We were both All-American, albeit D3. Like we've run quick enough to know enough about quick running and to see where we stand in the world. But let's just talk my cadence, Kirk. In a road mile where I ran 432, I averaged 184 steps per minute and peaked at 202 in the final 100 meters. 184 for a mile for 432. 432 is not world class. But it'd be a world-class woman.
I just watched a high school junior run 431, Sadie Englehart, so there you go.
Yeah, maybe a national-level woman.
17.
Yeah, she is an absolute talent.
Yep.
Going back to a faster road mile I ran 425 that day. I averaged 185 steps per minute and peaked at 206. So 184 and 185 were my averages for running sub 430 in a mile, 425 at 185 steps per minute. Could it be quicker? Yeah. But part of running is putting out the least effort possible. And so in a mile, you're trying not to run insanely fast until it's time to run insanely fast. Mm-hmm. Then we move to a 5K. This was a 5K tempo. I averaged 517 per mile, and I averaged 172 steps per minute, peaked at 192. This 5K tempo was on a cross-country course, 531 per mile, 172 steps per minute, 188 max. So 172 average on two different 5K tempos, off-road and on-road. This was a 10K on the roads. I averaged... Now, this was a hilly one, but 160... Oh, no, this wasn't a 10K. This was a 21-mile long-run time trial where I averaged 652 on semi-technical terrain. Averaged 166 steps per minute, peaked at 216. And then I ran a road 800 that was 403 per mile pace, and I averaged 191 steps per minute. So what I'm saying here is that in a sample size of one... I run pretty low cadence compared to what the stride experts would tell you to run. And when I raise my cadence up, I get a little faster. And when I raise it up significantly, I get a lot more tired. Mm-hmm. So everyone has room to improve. I have room to improve that. My cadence was a little quicker in college. It's not going to be the thing that keeps you from running fast unless it's the thing that keeps you injured. I don't overstride. I have a slow cadence, but I'm not much of an overstrider. So it's not high up on my priority list. We've talked about this before. I'd open my college season every year right around 420, 421. I'm running 425 to 430 road miles right now. I'm not that slow compared to that, and I'm running 180 cadence in a mile, 184. So my point is, I really don't care about it, guys, unless you're overstriding and getting hurt. Then you should stop.
I agree with all of that. And obviously, as the distance got further, your cadence went down. The purists are going to say your cadence should be the same no matter what speed your pace you're running. Your stride length should be what changes. There's merit to running under mass for sure. If you're struggling with injury in particular, could you benefit from maybe increasing your cadence? Probably. but is 180 the holy grail? It is not, in my opinion. And I'm sure somebody will fight us on that, but that's where I'm at with it. I don't think there's anything wrong with people saying, hey, quicken your cadence. Everybody, the 180 thing, when is somebody saying, oh, you're running 190? Let's bring it down to 180. Every single person who works on cadence is lower, 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 lower. And it's a common theme. We got to bring it up, bring it up, bring it up. Why 180? I don't know. Yep. Like, just bring it up maybe a little for starters, and that'll probably just set you in the right direction. 180 is arbitrary, in my opinion. That's all.
Yeah. I will absolutely agree with anyone who says most of us could improve if we improve our cadence slightly.
Yeah.
There is no merit to the number 180. And people who are using the number 180 did not do very good research on where that number came from. And if they're dying on that hill, then, well, that's falling on your sword. Don't fight that one. Seek to improve, not to hit a metric standard that has no basis in science or reality.
And you say something about, like, look to what the pros are doing, or if there was something really to it, like, everybody would be doing it. And you go listen to a pro's interview about their training, or you follow there's a lot of channels on YouTube which follow the best in the sports training or a workout. I never hear the word cadence. I hear the words threshold. I hear the words VO2 max. I hear the words talking about cleaning up their stride, whatever that means, and form work. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard the word cadence uttered from a pro or the pro's coach ever on, like, a top-end training video. There's other factors you're looking at that are more important.
Seek to improve, not to hit 180.
You'd be hearing it from the top.
Yep, you would.
We just don't hear it from the top. All right, next question. We spent more time on that than I thought we would. Alfred Young, Alfred, says, future Q&A. Do shoe insoles actually make much difference for running? Will top-end ones give you an edge in performance on race day?
So the only insoles I've seen, there's only two types of insoles I've seen that have promised or advertised increased performance with any amount of, believability. The first would be Victory insoles. I think it's just VKTRY. They are carbon fiber insoles that claim to make you faster and twitchier and more responsive. And it's important to note that carbon fiber by itself does not help you one bit. Carbon fiber only helps you if it helps the foam. Track spikes have used carbon fiber plates for years just to give you a stiff landing platform. It is really harsh to run on, and having it directly under your feet is just not the way to go. I'm sorry for anyone who's a believer in it, and I've had a few people reach out and say, hey, why haven't you tested this? I'm noticeably faster with this. I'm just going to say, well, great for you. I'm happy for you, but there's no basis in reality for other people's reality for that. Because again, let's look to the top. If carbon fiber directly under your feet was making the shoe its best, that's where Nike would have the plate. That's where Adidas would have the plate. That's where New Balance. That's where Mizuno. That's where all these brands would have the plate if that's where it interacted best with your foot in the foam, but it's not. The second thing to remember is that the plate must be designed to interact with the foam in order to actually benefit the foam. So if you're just adding it to a shoe that is not intended to pair with that plate, they will not work cohesively. You may get lucky and they may, but it's not designed for it. And there can be very little curvature to a insert. And so the curvature is what gives you any sort of propulsion. Otherwise, it's just rebound off the foam. And it's going to be very, very, very firm underneath your feet. So it will not be as comfortable. So from my standpoint, those have no basis in reality. The advanced supercritical footbeds are intriguing. The TPU or some sort of PBAX, PBA insoles that exist out there. Innovate has their Boomerang footbed. Kraft has a supercritical footbed. Several brands are messing with that now, and those are intriguing. That's just adding extra supercritical foam underneath your feet, and that's rarely a bad thing. So that could help you with cushioning. That could help you with energy return potentially, but just a carbon fiber performance insole is not something I'm a believer in. And again, I don't know anyone at the top end who's using it.
I just listened to a bracken in his natural environment flourishing.
Oh, yeah. Was it majestic?
I don't know about majestic, but it was informative. Maybe there'll be a majestic answer later.
In my mind, the breeze was flowing. My hair was waving.
Your eyebrows were, yep.
Rippling.
At least you got those. The only thing I was going to add, and then you you added that at the end was about an insert and the curvature of the carbon plate as well, like the energy return from it, like it needs to almost spring load, or, you know, it wants to propel you forward through a bend and snap, we'll call it, not the dance move. And it's like,
ooh,
you need to have the correct, here Bracken's about to show you something, I think, if for you guys watching on YouTube.
You keep going.
But a curvature, typically most of those carbon fiber plates that are inserted in your shoe between layers of foam or wherever they're put, have some sort of tipping point or rocker, you'll call it, in which you sort of compress as you hit the ground and it wants to spring you back up off the ground. You could call it a rocker, you call it anything. And so if you're just putting a carbon fiber insert into your shoe, without the right, I don't know, if it would have to lay in there just right, and that's going to just follow the curvature of your non-super shoe you're laying them in, and I'm most likely I don't see the return on that. You have way more to add to this conversation than I do, so I'm actually just going to leave it to you, and then we can move to the next question, but I don't think they're worth the money. Spend the extra money on the shoe itself.
No. So just visually, you can see where the plate sits in the super advanced shoes. It's in the upper third of the Puma.
Tell them what they're looking at there. Tell now, for those of you, we got a YouTube channel, you can go on and look, but Bracken's holding up a shoe and you can see the plate visibly crossing the arch of this. What is that, a nitro, a deviate? What is that? Deviate?
No, this is the Puma Fast Forward.
Okay, so now can explain what you're showing.
So the plate you can see enter into the heel about two-thirds of the way up the foam, and then it enters the forefoot at the very bottom of the foam to give less pressure and less neuroma feeling on your forefoot. And there is a noticeable dive down that does not follow the line of the shoe. So a insole could not do that. Adidas, you can see their energy rods. They use glass composite energy rods in there. You can see those are sitting just about halfway through. You can see it follows this orange strip. It starts up about three quarters and dives down abruptly down to the bottom third and then arcs back up to the middle of the midsole. You cannot get a curvature, an angle like that from an insole. And then finally, the newest of all of these, this is the craziest shoe I've ever run in and the fastest. This is the Mizuno Rebellion Pro 2. You can literally see where the plate is, upper third down to middle.
Mm-hmm.
If you look inside of it, that there's a gap in there where it starts, and in the forefoot there is less foam between the plate and the ground, and then there is more at the back. Again, they give you forefoot cushioning and the plate dives down to create a tip forward, and so that the foam can compress and launch in an angle. None of that can happen with an insole. So yeah, that's probably more than most people ever care about, but don't be fooled by those compress and spring tests that they love to put on social media, mm-hmm. where they take a shoe and they compress it and then it just flops down, and then they put a carbon plate into it and they compress it and it just flings forward, because you never wedge your foot in two directions against a stable point and then release. The comments on that are always like, how is this even legal? Well, because you don't run like that. You don't. So don't get fooled by that. That is not helping you at all. Unless your foot can do what they are showing that shoe to do, which, spoiler alert, your foot will shatter. It's not going to help you.
Not if your leg inserted in the middle of your foot, right on the top, and your heel was behind your ankle, your toes are in front. Now that was a majestic.
And you could load that puppy.
That was a majestic explanation, Bracken. That visual is helpful. If you don't follow us on YouTube, follow us on YouTube. Bracken broke that down really nicely. But you really pounded home the way the plate is laid in the foot in order to propel you forward. Should we move on? Because we got more questions to get to. I think we covered that one.
Let's do it. I'm done with that. I just really want to drive home that I believe it's snake oil. I believe it's a scam. Unless you're getting supercritical inserts, which I had a Kraft trail shoe. They're a carbon plated shoe. I hated the shoe. Instant felt like ankle tendonitis. But the footbed is fantastic. So I took the insole out and I put that into my shoes when I'm going really long, just for extra supercritical bouncing cushion in there. Mm. And it's delightful. Doesn't make me faster, but it makes my feet happier. I feel like I take less impact.
I did that with the inserts from the Scott Supertrack RC2.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That's the stickiest insole. That's for just trail work. I love that insole. Okay. John Larson says, second question, which is interesting because there's no first question. It's a blank conversation, but it starts off with second question. What are some strength and running standards to compete in high rocks at open weights? And how would you build both a strength and conditioning base for high rocks concurrently? John, this could be an entire episode in itself. So we're not going to do that question justice. But the first part, I think...
But we just did.
Tell me more. You mean with our high rocks?
On Training Tuesday. Yeah. How to train... Yeah, that's a good listen for this question.
So really, I think, why don't we focus on this part of John's question? What are some strength and running standards to compete in high rocks at open weights? And I will preface this. I'll set you up to fail, Bracken. I'll preface this with the fact in our episode we just released Tuesday, we said you could be weak in quotes and still outperform somebody who's strong.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's so many exceptions to these rules, but why don't we slap some numbers at people just to give them something?
All right. I'm going to take this a direction you probably did not expect.
Okay.
I think that a strength number you can shoot for is you should be able to, as a man, back squat 135 20 times without your life ending, and you are ready for age group high rocks.
I agree.
That's a strength standard I can get behind.
Well, and it's interesting because what he may be seeking and what others listening might be expecting is to say, well, you should be able to back squat 225 once and you should be able to bench 185 once. No, I don't give a crap what you can do for a single or even three or even five. It's what can you reproduce. So saying, could you back squat 185 by 10? You're going to be more than prepared for high rocks open weight if you can do nice, clean, full depth range of motion reps. So I don't think it's a one rep that you seek. It's how can I duplicate this? And I think the higher the rep count, the more accurate the test, because we do so many reps of everything in like a hybrid race. So I like that you just said 20 reps for a back squat, because I think that might be the indicator, is somewhere in that 10 to 20 rep range, probably 15 maybe being the sweet spot. Not what's my power for one rep, but a power lifter, like who weighs 300 pounds, mostly muscle even, and make him run a high rocks, and he's going to have a tough day, even though he can back squat 405 by 15. Strength standard doesn't matter. Endurance standards matter.
I either need to know 10 metrics, 5 lifting and 5 cardio, your ergs, your rower, treadmill challenge maybe, or 10K time. Like I'm going to need 8 to 10 metrics, or I don't care about any of them. But one data point's not going to help me much. But yeah, go through the 20 rep squat program or something like that. If you can have some muscular endurance, then you're set. Because again, take a look at people at the top of the sport. Chris Roglosky won a world championship, high rocks world championship. And at the time on her lifts, my guess is she would have been bottom 3 in that race of her maxes. And she won the race. We've had Dylan Scott just win North American championships. And he would probably be in the bottom at that DC race, of all the people who qualified age group and pro, he'd be in the bottom 50%, including the age group athletes, of overall maxes. And it might even be like bottom 30%. And it doesn't matter, because he can retain within like 10% of his max for probably 20 reps, at least 10. So I don't care about numbers, but maybe something like that.
Let's do it then. Let's go 20 rep, men and women, let's go back squat, deadlift, throw bench in there because people can just relate to it. It's so arbitrary, but bench and one other thing you might want to throw in there, walking lunges. If you could walking lunge with X amount of weight on your back for some. So let's start. You started with squat. Men, 135 pounds for 20 reps. I agree with you for open weight. If you can do that in some sort of cadence, not like I do 2 reps and then I think about it for 30 seconds, do 2 reps like in relative succession, you're going to be well or overprepared for what it's going to demand. Like 135 by 20 isn't easy by any means. Doing it somewhat smoothly, you're going to be
over. Do it in under a minute.
Sure. I would say for women, 95 pounds. Not even, maybe 85. Let's say 95 pounds.
I'm happy with 95.
Roughly. Okay, let's go to the next one.
deadlift. I mean, I'm tempted to say the same thing, but let's just call it like 155 and 115.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to jump to 185 on the deadlift, and I thought about it, and I'm like, that's too much. It doesn't even need to be that. 165 sounds right. Maybe 170.
Same thought process. Yeah.
And then, yeah, 115.
170, 135, or 155, 115, something like that.
Bench press. All that benching you're doing out on course, Bracken.
Oh. Honestly, it's somewhere between 95 and 105 for men, 20 reps. If you can do that, you're going to get through the burpee broad jumps.
I thought 115, but...
I'm happy with 115.
And 75 pounds for the women? 70? 65?
Yeah. 70, 75, yeah.
Okay, and then try to put a number to walking lunges.
I think this matters more. I think for the men, you should be able to...
I think you need to increase the weight.
Yeah, I think I'm going to put 85 pounds on your back, and you need to be able to do at least 50 reps unbroken. You can tap at the top of each one. It's a little arbitrary, but I'm going to say 85 by 50. No 2 foot standing ever, other than a tap.
I was going to say 100 pounds on the back, 20 reps in succession, not terribly phased when it's done for men, for women. I would still keep it pretty high, probably 70 pounds, maybe 60, okay. Sure. But I was just going to use the 20 rep thing. But if you do that, you're not going to be over your head on any one thing. To the point where you like are questioning if you can complete.
No. Correct.
More is better though. Yeah. To a point.
And I guess overhead press.
Okay. Like a push press?
Yeah. Maybe even like military press.
Okay. How about seated dumbbell military press? Let's do that.
Seated dumbbell. Like it. I'm going to say you've got to be able to do 20 reps with 20 pounds.
For men?
I probably want to say like 30 pounds. Eat per hand. 30?
I was going to say 40. That is kind of high.
80 is just a lot of weight.
Maybe for you.
Yeah. I'm thinking, could Dylan Scott have done it back when he was like a 62-minute guy?
Mm.
That's kind of my litmus test for all of this. And I'm not sure if he could have done 40s then, but he would have crushed most people's souls.
This isn't like a humble brag, but it's an interesting note I made. And I talked to people at the gym about this. I took last week off of running, as in like I firmly believe about a week every 6 months off as a reset if you're training with purpose, blah, blah, blah. I've shoved that down your throat over the years. But I still hit strength work in the gym. And so I do like traditional lifts still. I enjoy them. So I do a seated military press, typically once a week heavy. And in sets of 8 and in heavy training like normal, I'm usually 70-ish pounds, about 70-pound dumbbells, like military press for 8. And it's a lot of work. Sometimes I'll fail on my last set. I didn't run all last week. That's impressive. Well, that's not the impressive part. The impressive part, and I almost wanted to video it just to be like, but I didn't have an output all week, and I was recovering, and I was throwing 80-pound dumbbells over my head. Now, for 2 sets of 8, and then I had to go down to 75.
Seated,
full breaking parallel, and just the difference in like not the calorie expenditure, the energy expenditure of running. I couldn't even get them up once or twice probably in a heavy training block of running. And then I go to the gym, like kind of charged up, kind of feeling fat and sloppy. Hadn't run in 6 days. I did it on a Thursday or a Friday, so I hadn't run since the previous Saturday. It was just like everything just went easy. It was unbelievable how much of a depletion we are running around in from our endurance training. Like all my lifts were fantastic. It's just really interesting, the energy allotment system when you're like running so hard on the body. Like I don't use my shoulders much to run, yet my military press went up roughly 10 pounds. I felt like the man. I haven't lifted that much in years on that lift. And it has to just be.
I've never been able to do that.
Well,
that much.
I'm just saying like a 10-pound difference for 8 reps is 20 total is astounding. And it just has to do with like.
It's astounding, yeah.
Right? Like we're beating ourselves up with this endurance crap. I'm telling you. That's all I wanted to say. It was just an interesting note.
Yes, we are.
Okay. Should we move on? Next one?
We shall.
All right. Let's see here. Tyler Ortega. Question for the next Q&A. Recently came into a standing desk at work, and I do 3 to 4 runs per week on my lunch break. What are some best practices post-run to maximize the efficiency of the standing desk to help my legs build fatigue resistance? I've been alternating 60 minutes standing, 60 minutes sitting per your buddy, ChatGPT, but curious on your thoughts. Training for a half later this summer, if it makes any difference. Already doing, 14.5 mile long runs on the weekends, just trying to stop the stomping that inevitably starts around 11 mile. So if I'm understanding correctly, he is looking, if we have any thoughts on utilizing his standing desk to correlate to training and performance.
This is an unfounded belief, but I'm going to state it anyways because it's our podcast.
Yes, it is.
I do not believe standing throughout the day, time on feet, not moving, is a performance enhancer until you get past the, I'm going to say 3 hour mark in races. And that's going to be at the low end.
I thought you were going to say four.
I would, except for like a 20 to 30 mile a week athlete would probably benefit from standing for a 3 hour race.
Sure.
Only in like the last 20 to 30 minutes. But I could be convinced to say four or five. Until you get to the ultra distance or a long time on feet marathon, I don't believe there's any performance benefit to doing it. Long-term health from not having your spine and your hips in a hunched or closed off position, very beneficial. So I actually wouldn't strive for longer time on feet. I would maybe strive for less time sitting, which to me would mean more frequent sit breaks and less time sitting. That's probably how I would approach it. Hour on, hour off seems very aggressive for someone also trying to run volume and quality workouts and do well at a half. So I don't want to rain on your parade, but I think you're probably already doing a lot and you could stand to reduce duration rather than extend it.
I think it's a great question. I echo your response to Tyler's question, which is, I don't think it's going to help you run faster one bit in your half marathon. I don't even think a second faster if you change up your scheme and get it perfectly right in whatever world that looks like. And I second your answer with, it's better to like, our hip flexors get super bound up. Our lower backs and hamstrings get super bound up sitting in a seated position all day. If for nothing else, it's going to keep your hips open. And maybe it's going to prevent some of that stiffness and tightness, which could affect your gait, which could translate to run performance improvements potentially and just a smoother feeling while running. But as far as mounting fatigue, zero. Zero, zero, zero benefit, no matter what system you use. It's not going to work that way for a half. I agree about the duration. That dull ache in your legs that starts to set in at the end of a long run or a long race, you can start to maybe feel in a standing desk. I think there is some warrant to time on foot for the ultra space, not for a half marathon.
All right, so I'm going to ask you. You're preparing for a race. Mm-hmm. What is the shortest distance or duration it could be for you to start considering the use of standing throughout the day to build race readiness?
Moab 240. I ain't doing that crap unless it's something super extreme. What a waste of time. That's what I think. That's my answer. If I'm doing like a 24 hour plus, maybe, but probably not because it's annoying to have to do that. Maybe a multi-day hike trek venture, something, but I'm not doing it. Silly, I think, because my efforts are best spent elsewhere is how I feel about it. I think there's a warrant and merit to it, but I know I swung really hard on the other side, one side of this coin. So what is your answer?
I mean, my gut just wants to say 24 hours, but I think it's whenever I would start to deal with foot problems, like foot swelling or foot pain. It could be 12, could be 18 hours. It's probably course dependent, but I don't think I would consider it a performance benefit for myself for less than 12 hours. I'd be hard pressed to find a reason for that for less than 12, because I'd rather recover fully and put more energy into training. It's not until you go overnight that I think you need that resistance to just being on your feet in a really depleted, slow state. I mean, I shouldn't throw myself into it because I haven't raced past 6 hours and I'm not a stud ultra runner. But like you could look at yourself and say the same way I would think, that even if you're running up to 12 hours, you're going to be running aggressively enough that your standing fitness isn't going to factor into it. You're going to be working hard the entire time. So it's probably close to 24 hours is the answer.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's probably a place for it. I'm just not gonna. I don't want to. It's as simple as that. There's probably merit for...
And there's two ways to do it.
Yeah. I mean, like going for like a 3-hour long run and then doing yard work all day and not sitting down, and you spend another 10 hours feeling that dull ache in your legs, like just getting familiar with it and working through it. There may be merit to that. But to make it like a regular part of your training, I don't know. I think you'd benefit from a nap that day as much or more than pushing through and standing on your feet for the sake of fatigue.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. I think that it's for people who can't run volume.
True.
If you're training for a 100-miler and you can't go past 30 or 40 or 50 miles per week, yeah, you should probably stand all day if you can. But if you can run 80 to 100 miles, you should just get off your feet and recover for the next run. So if your work schedule and your life schedule means you can't run doubles and you can't do more than 10 miles at a crack, yeah, that's probably for you then. But again, only once you get to 12 to 24 hours.
And you're very right. If you can't run mileage, stand or walk on your feet would probably move the needle in some regard. It's a good point. Chris Johnson asks, what's up, Chris? He's a local Minnesota guy. He ran Zumbro, beat his old last year's time by like 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. Way to go, Chris. Q&A. I've been thinking about how I'm really in the mood for a good carry workout and putting those consistently into my next block of workouts. Bracken's dog loop, Kirk's Hill repeats plus carry. I know he's using those as examples. I no longer race OCR, and I don't plan to anytime soon. So is there a place for carry workouts anymore for someone like me? Or is it something that's just more damaging than anything else and shouldn't waste my time on them unless I'm doing an OCR race? Actual question. Is there a place for carry workouts in a general fitness workout plan? Thanks, guys.
I'm going to refer you back to my previous answer. From a performance standpoint, nah. No, probably not. But if it makes you happy or it loads your spine and that's something you need more of, good. But I'm not a huge proponent of loaded movement, like walking, jogging under load. I think if you're going to compete that way, you have to train to be able to handle it. But if you're not going to compete with a jostling weight on your back, I don't really see much need to ever put your body through that. I'd rather just load it more and squat it or lunge it. I don't like the impact forces or the jostling that happens with rucking. I don't think anyone's ever proved that rucking is the best thing for you long term. Until they do, I'm not on board.
Some of the strongest power lifters in the world will tell you, unless you're a power lifter, don't deadlift. It's so bad for you. For example, that'll come from those doing the deadlifting, right? It's not that severe with carries, but trap and neck issues, lower back, just tight and stiffness, all of that can definitely flare up and then impact maybe your training afterwards. I really struggled with the front bucket carry in Spartan Race at first, and then it messing up my lower back and then kind of impacting my training afterwards. So is the juice worth the squeeze? Maybe, but maybe not. But what I will say is I started implementing, like, it's OCR season, and a few people I coach, We shifted from like, let's build our floor to let's build our OCR ceiling, which means now we're doing compromise quality sessions, carry work on Thursdays. And I have two athletes that said, I don't know why, but I feel so much more dynamic, like an athlete now. It's how they feel, because instead of just running in a line all the time and lifting super linear in the gym, like I feel like I'm moving my body animalistic, right? In ways in which it's not forced to move. And I like how that makes me feel. And I think there's something to it. I think there's just something to putting heavy. I love putting my backpack on, strapping my bow to myself, and tromping through the woods with 40 pounds of crap on me in a weird way, going over stumps and walking through creeks. It's really satisfying to move through ranges of motion and different things under load. And I can't describe why, but it makes me feel like a man. Maybe it makes a woman feel like a woman. Feels good. So I think that's just backing up your point. Like, if it makes you feel like, if it provokes some sort of rah-rah in you, or it makes you feel more versatile and that translates to confidence, throw that crap in your plan. Sure. Just be aware if it's negatively impacting your workouts the next couple of days, or suddenly you have a kink in your neck all the time and you don't know why, and that's lingering. I guess I really didn't answer that question. I just basically told anybody to do what they want to do, really, in regards to that question. But that's how I feel.
Yep. Yeah. I don't think it's going to make you a better runner.
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to give you better fitness. but it may make you happier or feel more well-rounded. If you want best of both worlds, do farmer's carry or do weighted marching. Just standing in place, weighted marching. It's all the rage in the online communities right now, but I think there's real merit to it. So do that.
I've never seen weighted marching raging across the internet.
You grab one dumbbell or two and just do high knees. It's good stuff.
Know what I've been proud of in the gym? I see random gym guys, some, again, eye test only means so much, some looking the part and some not, we'll say, doing single arm farmer's carries up and down the gym. They'll put a 35 pounder in one hand. I see a handful of people doing this now, which I never used to see that. Like guys that'll hit a real like traditional lift and then farmer's walk or carry with a single down and back for 100 meters and then switch arms and do it, which I'm like, yeah, that's functional training. I don't know. Maybe that's the rage that I'm missing somewhere in the social media world.
It's good rage.
Next question.
Next.
Chris John. Hey guys, Q&A question. Of all the do's and don'ts for overall training, the last few days preparing for a race, running a race, etc., which rules do you break the most consistently? So the do's and don'ts.
Ooh.
The few days, let's say the last 3 days leading into a race. So let's focus on the which rules do you break. Which rules do you break the most consistently? Go.
Sleep. Sleep. I screw that one up as much as anything on earth.
Like you won't get very good sleep sometimes, like minimal hours and still go race.
Yep. And it'll be two nights before. I'll be like, I know I should already have my packing done. Now it's suddenly 11 o'clock and I'm still standing over my suitcase or whatever it is, or I'm downstairs laying out my bottles. And that's just what it is. I say sleep is the thing I screw up the most often.
Yeah, that one I really try my best. And it's not because you like wake up at 3 a.m. and you're anxious and can't sleep. It's like you just don't get to bed on time.
Two nights before, I just don't get to bed on time. And most often it's because it's less these days, but typically if I'm racing, I'm leaving the area to race. So I might be gone for a night or two. And so I spend later at night with the kids and then later at night with Lisa. And then I start to get my stuff done and now it's too late. And this was my big sleep night and I screwed it up. Night before, yeah, a lot of times I just still will not sleep very well at all. It's very fitful. I wake up 30 times or something like that. But that's acceptable. You know that's coming. The two nights before, I screw up myself.
I'm going to ride the fringes here and say a three-letter word, sex. Everybody's ears perked up. I think everybody thinks in the back of their head in relation to their race, whether they should or shouldn't be doing it because of performance. I think it goes on in the back of almost everybody's head. Like, yeah, we should or shouldn't tonight. I want to or I don't want to because I have a race tomorrow or in 2 days. I think everybody thinks about that. And I think everybody's wrong. I think it's superstition. If you get a night's sleep after your last bout of hanky panky, I've had some of my best races the day after a rage session. And I've also had some of my worst races without doing it for a week beforehand. Like it, and then vice versa. It doesn't matter as long as you're resetting with like a REM sleep cycle. So I know that's a weird angle to take. It's the only thing, like I have no real steadfast rules other than like, I think a lot of people wonder that. And I don't think it matters whatsoever. I don't think you should wake up in the morning and do a little before your race. Like I think that will negatively impact your testosterone, estrogen levels, and probably thus performance. But if you're getting a night's sleep, I don't think it matters whatsoever. And so I just thought I would get that out there.
Yeah. There's a small window where there's a dip in performance for men afterwards. Less so for women. And there have been studies on this. And the last one I read, there's a study on maximum exertion grip strength. And then I don't know if it was like an erg or something and like a deadlift. There were a couple different studies on it, but it showed a little bit of a drop within like 30 minutes or less after. But I mean, really, if that's happening 30 minutes or less before a race, you were probably going to race poorly anyway. So, like, if that's where your
mind's
focus
not
is,
in the right place,
but yeah. Day before, yeah, yeah, and you probably didn't train well enough. If you got to race morning, you're like, you know what, I could really go for right now with the race in 40 minutes. So you just
squeeze
it
in between the diarrhea
night before, no discernible. Yeah, like race morning is for explosive, repeated diarrhea and trying to choke down your pre-race meal. there's anything else than that, you're not ready.
You meet a hottie in the porta potty line, and you switch gears. You're like, oh, the woods back there is pretty secluded. You never know.
Yeah, not a chance.
Okay, should we leave that one alone? Do you want to make up some other stuff in the last 3 days that rule breaks?
No, I'm pretty good. I practice what I preach on race week. I will say, though, that I have never had a good feeling week of the race unless I'm training through a race. I hate tapering. I don't mind being lazy in life. I hate tapering before a race. My mind goes crazy. I go stir crazy. I would normally not mind taking a day off or lowering my volume, but all I can do is think about what I'm not doing and what I am doing and how it's right or wrong or how crappy I feel. And I cannot stand my final quality session before a race because the entire thing, all I'm thinking about is how it should be feeling or how it isn't feeling. I cannot stand race week. Cannot stand it. But I do most things right other than sleep.
Yeah, or like it'll be like 2 days before the race or a day before the race. And you're just like walking down your driveway and you're like, my legs feel tight today. Why do they feel tight today? God, they feel sluggish. I don't even want to.
Yep.
It's like really weird. It's like suddenly you pay attention to those things. You're like, that's messing with my brain. I agree with you on that. Our minds are tricky.
Yeah.
Then the gun goes off and it's fine. All right. Jeff Coolin.
Everything's fine.
For the next Q&A, I like this question. I think a lot of people have this question. For the next Q&A, what pace do you need to be running to make a super shoe worth using? Part two, how do you recommend transitioning into them? Super shoe guy, talk to me.
I don't believe there's a pace. You see this a lot. There are even some shoes that have said we're designated to be run 6:10 or faster. I don't buy that one bit. I buy that there is a stride type that's useful for a super shoe. And it's your aggressive stride. And that is very, very general and non-specific. But we all know that feeling from when we're running easy to when we start running more aggressively. And that's when a super shoe kicks in for a performance standpoint. The more aggressively you run, the more aggressively the shoe helps you. So the faster the pace, the better. But the more aggressive the stride, the better. And the angle of impact and getting more forefoot helps in almost every super shoe. So that's a stride type, not a pace type. There are people that toe strike at 8 minute miles. There are people that don't toe strike until they get under 6 or 4 foot strike. So that's my performance standpoint. If it's a cushioned super shoe rather than a harsh super shoe, the physical benefits of it are immediate. It's reduced damage to your legs if it's a shoe that is not harsh and stiff, which some super shoes are.
Yeah, I was going to go right to like the foam squishy sort of answer, which is going to ultimately more time on foot. Typically a slower in quotes runner is going to have more ground contact time, potentially more damage, we'll call it, from the running process. And so the super foam combined with the super shoe, like I think those can be very beneficial for enduring pace over duration. But you couldn't be more correct about how your foot hits the ground. You can be slow in quotes and be a 4 foot striker. They exist. And you know what? Then you need to find the right one that hits you there. Midfoot striker. I've talked about, and we talked about recently, how we feel like the plate in a shoe can work for you or work against you. I think you probably have to be even more critical the slower the pacing you're running in quotes. But there's absolutely a super shoe out there that makes a 12 minute miler more efficient. I don't know which one that 100%. Would be. Necessarily, that's going to be an experimental thing, but I don't think you could be too slow to benefit from a super shoe. You may have more limited options.
No.
If you're slower.
Yes.
But that'd be it.
And I think on the other side of the coin, like the opposite end of the spectrum, the same thing happens. Would you wear an Alphafly for a road mile right now? Would that be your number one choice?
I could run pretty dang well in it. It's going to be in the conversation.
Could you? But would you feel the most confident?
Probably not for a mile, no.
Yeah. And yet, like, what are you looking to run in the mile? How much faster than Eliud Kipchoge's marathon pace?
Barely. I mean, really.
These guys are, from time to time, dipping into the 420s in the mile during a marathon in the Adios Pro 3 or in the Alphafly or in some of these shoes we would consider the slow, grindy, bouncy shoes. we would feel uncomfortable running 4:30 pace in an Alpha Fly potentially, or kicking home the last 400 meters because we're running so aggressively in it. Whereas he's gliding at 4:30 pace, and so it's not too aggressive for the shoe. So again, I don't believe it's pace that determines if the shoe is right. working. It's your stride aggression. And I think that's important to remember on both sides.
I believe Kelvin Kiptum, rest in peace, threw in a 4:19 in his Alpha Flies somewhere in the middle of his world record marathon. Case in point.
That's just so gross. And it's a good reminder why their marathon shoes aren't our marathon shoes necessarily. They're getting done in 2 hours and they're running on their forefoot and they're getting off the ground quickly. I can't heel strike in the Adios Pro 3 for 2.5 hours. No way.
Next question comes from Michael Grieve. It's an athlete I coach. He sent this to me via email. So Bracken, you have not had privy to this question. Michael says,
you know that I haven't seen a single one of these.
Oh, all right.
I did worse research than I thought.
It's better to just take them as they come. I really think so. Like instinct answer without overthinking it. Question is,
there's one I'm waiting for that I did see, and she asked to remain anonymous. So that's the only one I've for sure seen and like had an answer in mind.
And we got to get Boogie in on this stuff to make sure we get to them all. So here it is. He says, met a nice guy by the name of Ryan that hung with me for the last 15, implying the last 15 minutes of his run. While running with him, it made me want to ask you about a topic for TRP with Bracken. When do you guys think it's necessary to get a training partner, whether for weight training or running? When you've hit a plateau and changed training styles and you haven't broken through? Or can it be a weekend type thing you and Bracken did that helps you break that next level? What are both of your thoughts on that? Appreciate all the help. And once again, great job on the rate.
Do you have concrete thoughts on this?
Yes.
Because mine have changed over the years and they've been concrete every time, but it has changed.
Okay, well, I'll start, you finish. So, it varies from person to person. Often running with others is a hindrance schedule-wise, emotional energy-wise, and then some it's the exact opposite, right? It's an enhancer. I think whether you believe you are a lone wolf or not, I am going to get the I feel like I am one of the best hardworking solo running guys I know. I can go out there and get it done on my own and be effective. Nope. I still think I'm not accessing a percentage of my ability by running alone on quality days, no matter what. Whether it's drafting and running a relaxed pace for longer before I have to sink my teeth in, whether it's taking risks early because I'm running with somebody better than me. Better than you is the key, I think. Even though I feel like I'm doing a great job of squeezing all the juice out of my quality days that matter, not a chance am I accessing everything I could be on some of those sessions because I'm training alone. And I firmly believe that. So if you think you're not going to do any better with or without other people around, you're wrong. That's my opinion. Mm-hmm. I think if you're somebody who dreads the run and cuts them short, doesn't show up, skips, like a training partner just for the novelty of that and ensuring it gets done, great. But if not, I don't think it makes a difference whatsoever other than peak performance. That's why you see training camps and groups. That's why you see the top ends running with all the best around them. It does make a difference. Even if you're the fastest one, but you got guys nipping on your heels and you know if you underperform that day, they might catch you. That's a benefit too. So those are my concrete thoughts.
Yep. Everyone's better with help. That's just the way it is. My fifth year of college, I was student teaching and I had 21 credits in order to get out on time. And on time meaning in my fifth year. It's kind of start to college I had. I was making up for lost time. As a result, I could not practice with the team 4 out of 5 days per week.
Oof.
And we didn't run together on the weekends at Whitewater. It's kind of strange. So I did, 80% of my training for mid-distance track, 800 and 1500 meters or the mile. My final year of college, 80% of it was done alone. And I PR'd everything. And that sold me on the fact that I'm a lone wolf runner. And the cementing fact to me on that was that I'd get to a race and it felt like I just had a personal escort around the racetrack. Sure. Like, look at all these people sharing the load with me. It's so easy to run next to people when I'm used to doing it alone. And I wasn't a person who struggled in a pack, so it was fine for me. And yet, any time I ran with someone else, I ran faster. And I used to think, because I'm working harder to run slower alone, when I get into a race, it's just free energy. And there's some truth to that. But if the idea is really to run as fast as possible, as often as possible, as Jakob Ingebrigtsen famously said, the training partners are like super shoes. They allow you to get more work done and get faster reps in, and probably cleaner reps because there's eyes on you. And so you're leaving something on the table. Even though I was successful, I think I could have been more successful without it. And it has just become more and more cemented over the last few years that we're at our best when we train with someone. I go for a workout with you and I get like 20% more work done than I would have anyway.
Yeah.
And it's probably 10% faster. And so it doesn't have to be every day, but I believe we need help in our lives at everything. And running's no different.
Could not agree more. I could take or leave it on recovery efforts, on long runs that don't have a quality component. That's more about just tolerating it, like mentally, emotionally. But for the quality stuff, if you can find, and I don't even seek it out really, because it'd be an inconvenience schedule wise, right? For me, I run in the middle of the day. That's my break. Yep. Nobody else can, yada, yada. But even like in a workout, like you mentioned, like we got together and whether you think, you know, I perform better than you or not, I worked harder, got more out of it, even if I was training with somebody in quotes that didn't have the fitness I had, I still got more out of that session with you there than without question. We're circling the same waters. I think that's important. Right. If you're night and day different, it's a little different, but, you know, an ideal setup would be like run with somebody faster on a quality day and run with somebody slower on all your other runs and you're going to be set. That doesn't work itself out that way, but often.
Yeah. Use people for things that you struggle with. If you're never doing strides or core, meet up with someone a couple times a week that you know is going to make you do strides in core. Every single time we do a long run, our comment is 2 hours or 3 hours have never gone by so fast.
Yep.
If I'm struggling to do long runs, I need someone to talk to. Then I'll be out there forever. Yeah. So use people for the thing you're not great at.
And Bracken can talk into perpetuity on a long run too. It's unbelievable. He doesn't even need to breathe on a long run. He can just talk his way through it. And somewhere in there, the breaths happen. It's unbelievable skill you have.
I can breathe through any orifice, so I can just talk all day long.
I'm not going to ask any follow-up questions here. Next one. Aaron Cummins says, Q&A question if you get to it. I'm slow AF, she says. So when you're talking about 60 to 90 minute runs.
I like the confidence.
Aaron says.
Leading with confidence.
So when you're talking about 60 to 90 minute runs, that's not a lot of mileage for me. I'm not going to be running a 10K in 60 minutes, and I'm usually on trails. So these 60 to 90 minute workouts are 4 to 7 miles, maybe 8 on a great day. If you're this level of slow, what does that translate to in minimum time on feet per week or really any of the times mentioned in these episodes? I run 8 to 10 hours a week, but that might only be 40 to 45 miles. I'm training for everything from 10K to 24 hours.
This is the one of those really tough pieces to work with. Mm-hmm. And my short, lazy answer is it doesn't change a single thing for me. You're a high volume athlete at 8 to 10 hours a week.
Yep.
And maybe that becomes 10 to 12, but if you're slow, then you just can't run big mileage, but you run big volume of training. And that's just what it is. And there's no way around that. To be an 80 mile a week runner, you're going to have to be a 20 hour a week runner. And that is not feasible or sustainable, most likely for you and your lifestyle. So don't even aspire to it. Just give up on it. Give up on the miles and be in hours. I'm a 10-hour a week woman and I am high mileage. I mean, for me, I'm high volume. That's what it is. And over time, hopefully you just get a little faster, but I wouldn't stress over it because it's physiologically impossible to be doing that type of running mileage. So don't worry about it.
Erin knows this deep down. She knows that exact thing you just said. She knows that the answer isn't to go put in 20-hour weeks to hit mileage requirements. The answer is to stick to the foundation time principles. Whether you're running 3 hours on foot at 7-minute pace or at 15-minute pace, the aerobic output The amount of damage and time on feet is really roughly the same. Could you argue you're underprepared then for an ultra event because you haven't covered enough distance in training? That argument's always going to be there. But physiologically, you're going to get no more or very little return on investment past the typical principles and durations. Time-wise, we talk about juice isn't worth the squeeze for you. I assume you got other components to your life than training. And if this is sustainable and you're injury-free and you show up available at these races, I think your 8 to 10 hours is going to be plenty. And yeah, a 24-hour race may be daunting to you because you don't spend that much time on foot. Don't worry, it's daunting to everybody. So I agree with you. I don't think you worry about mileage at all. You become a time-based athlete solely, and that's that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you take your lumps on race day. But the fact is, if in a 60-minute run, you're not averaging under 10 minutes per mile, then you're probably not looking to try to podium at these ultras. And if that's off the table, that's kind of freeing. Okay, I don't need 100-mile weeks. I'm not trying to win this thing. So stay healthy.
Yeah.
There's only so much you can do. If we wouldn't expect an elite runner to run 20 hours a week, why would we expect a non-elite runner to do it? Your body has the same recovery demands, except that you're moving slower. And so you have longer ground contact time probably. So there's no reason to stress it further.
Right. We have 19 minutes at most, and we have a handful of questions. So we're going to pick up the cadence slightly. How's that sound? Deal?
Deal.
Okay. This is from KW. KW says, Q&A submission. This question is about your recommendations for training distance depending on the OCR race distance. You've had guests on that have recommended 20% over race distance and 25 to 35% less than actual race distance to be prepared. Do you think it depends on race distance, person, terrain, goals, all of the above? What are your personal preferences? Thanks, Kenny. Kenny Wade, right?
Yeah,
I believe. All right, so what do you think?
Are we talking volume per week or a long run? How did you understand that?
I understood that as long run compared to race distance.
Okay. The further I go into life, the less I care about matching volume and long run distance to a prescribed ratio of race distance. The more I just think, let's run as much volume as we can run while handling our quality work without tipping over. And let's get 2+ hours on the long run. And whether you're training for a OCR 5K or an OCR 50K, you're going to be set. The only difference I do is I go extra long for extra long races. You and I rarely cut out the 90 to 2 hour runs until we get within like 3 to 4 weeks of a short race. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to give a ratio because I think you just always run long and always run volume.
I mean, I had a
not helpful.
I had a 5K I cared a lot about, and we went for a 2 hour run 2 weeks beforehand, right? I think if you're racing a 10K distance or above, or you're racing, let's call it 45 minutes or above, you got to hit 2 hours. Go hit 2 hours for your long runs. I think no, you don't gotta, you really should. I think that even on the pro level, if you're a 10K athlete, those guys are going out running 18. Maybe for them that doesn't take 2 hours, but they're hitting pretty solid mileage and all they care about is speed, not on terrain. So point being is, I think err on the side of like, if I'm running 10K to half marathon, you got to be hitting 2 hours. If I'm running 45 minutes to 2-3 hour races, you got to hit 2 hours in your long runs. If it's longer than that, you might want to look at upping it to 3 potentially if you can handle it and you think you'll benefit from it. But if you're racing less than a 10K, maybe you're stopping at 45 minutes as your ceiling as far as race duration or a 5K, then sure. But I'd still like to see 90. I still would I'm not going to stop you from going out and doing 90 minutes. So I don't know if that's helpful or not, but
I think it is. I think I've talked a lot that the goal as a runner should be to get to the point where you can run an hour on any given day without it negatively impacting you. And I believe that you should be able to go at least 90 minutes to 2 hours on any given long run without it impacting you.
Yeah.
Regardless of race distance, 5K or above.
We have 5 questions left and we have 15 minutes-ish. We can do this. All right. Scott Haight says, I'm someone who saw some success in high school and collegiate running in the mile and 800, 419 for the mile, 154 for the 800. I'm 43 now.
Oh, I saw this one, Kirk.
Uh-oh. So you lied to me before. He says, I'm 43 now. We'll save you a backstory of running history since then, but I do have a running strength coach and continue to compete in OCR and trail running. As aging runners, no offense intended, who saw levels of success both collegiate and post-collegiately, how do you keep yourself out of the mindset of not feeling washed up? Which I do, meaning he says he's feeling washed up, because of inability to reach what were once easily achievable goals. Example, sub 5 minute mile. Do you ever wish you had not achieved at the levels you had so that the comparison of then to now or in the future wouldn't be so drastic? These are current insecurities I am vocalizing and looking for advice and perspective. Thanks so much. And I just want to say I respect the heck out of this question, vulnerability-wise. I think a lot of people go through this.
Yeah. This is every competitive spirit on earth fights this battle at some point. This is something, this cliff is something that I dreaded my entire life. And I can confidently say, no, I don't regret any performance I did younger.
Because that stands with you forever.
And
you have that forever.
Yeah. And there's something about the journey, the work that it took to get there is justified by the time. And it tells what you were doing in life at that time. You've got it forever, like you said. And how do you get around that? Some people never do. But I find that you just adjust the goal. All right, I'm going to get better at 10K. I'm going to get better at half marathon. I'm going to run an ultra. I'm going to try a triathlon. It's, you've picked something that you've never maximized and you go PR in it. That's my workaround. It's not for everyone, but that's mine. That's why I try so many funky different things. It's something new to try to be successful at.
Look at Matt Novakovich, for example. Even Hunter McIntyre. It's a new thing every 6 months.
Yep.
And you know what? It keeps him hungry.
Yep.
And it's awesome. I'm going to use one word here, ego. I would like to think as we mature as adults, let the ego slowly but surely diminishes with age. As it should, I believe. We don't need to be full of bravado anymore because we're secure in who we are, what we've accomplished up to this point. And ideally, if you mature in any sort of emotional intelligence way, your ego should lessen as you age. Along with that means hopefully your ego can take it that you will never be as fast as you have been in the past, and that's okay because other things fill your cup now. It's not easy. I'm not belittling it because I can tell I'm on the edge of it, guys. But whether you think I have a giant ego or not, mine is so much smaller than it used to be, and I accept whatever next phase I can help others with or my next phase of life or pursuits. And as you said, just had this conversation with somebody the other day, and it was, you know what? I've taken some pretty big swings at some of this stuff, and I very much may pivot to something extreme, like extreme ultra. I may only do 50Ks and above now and find my next thing, whether it's because it's a diluted field or because age doesn't impact your ability to endure over time, I may pivot for the sheer fact of that little bit of ego that's left in me that says I got to win or I got to do these things. But either way, I think you just know that you have company and it's okay. And you recognize the benefits outweigh the downsides of aging and performing. You understand that longevity becomes the ultimate goal. And at some point, we're all going to shift to it. And I'm staring it right in the face. And I know I'm not over it yet. I haven't stepped over that line yet, but I know it's coming. And I'm already bracing myself for it. So I just want to give you a little back rub and be like, it's okay, man. But keep fighting. That's it.
It is. It's important for people to disassociate themselves from their performances. You are not your times. You are your fitness, and you are the work you've put in. That's it. You are not your times. You were once. That was you at that moment, and it's not anymore, and it doesn't reflect upon you anymore. You are the work you're putting in right now. No more and no less.
Preach. Probably not the most satisfying answer you could have received, but that's the one you're getting today. And it's from the heart, so. Chaz Edmonds.
Father Time is undefeated.
Sure is.
So there's no beating it. There's just no beating it.
Unless you're Kenenisa Bekele. That guy can screw off. Just ran 204 in the marathon at 41.
Yep.
Okay.
Stupid.
Chaz Edmonds says, Q&A Friday question. What's a good weekly mileage for a high school cross-country runner? Let's say a decently seasoned kid. Here, 30 miles a week. That's a great amount of volume for a high school cross-country runner. You run 30 miles a week in high school and you stay healthy doing it, you're going to get 99% of the way there for the average high school cross-country runner. That's what I think. What do you think?
All right. I'm going to go the opposite direction. I'm not giving you a number.
Okay.
As little as possible while still improving. You have your whole life to run more mileage. If you want more training volume, get on the elliptical, get on the bike, get on the cross-country skis, swim. I do not care. Run the least amount you can get away with running while still training and improving. You do not need to raise volume of running when you are young until you stop improving or until you have so much energy that you don't know what to do with it. Put all your extra energy into other forms of training as long as possible into life, unless you are training for the Olympics.
Last thing you want to do is beat yourself into injury constantly and hate the sport that you once enjoyed. But I'm still saying 30 miles. Screw it. Saying 30 miles.
That's great. It's a good number. But I want you to, if you like running now, I want you to do what it takes to feel that same way when you're our age. That's the number you should run.
Your answer is correct, but let's move on. All right. This is our anonymous question. It says, hey, I have a question for the Q&A. Please, please, capital please, keep this anonymous. I like it. I like it. All right. And the question says, how do you know when it is time to find a new coach? It's a heavy one because it's our life. It's our livelihood.
Well, Steve.
It's a heavy question because it impacts us personally, this question. You feel for the athlete. You feel for the coach potentially. I have a one that comes to my head immediately. And this may be an interesting take, but if you feel like you consistently care notably more than your coach does and your feelings are valid, it's time to move on. That one simple thing. If you feel like they don't care enough or they're not invested at least to a satisfactory level on your end, move on. That's it. That alone, but regardless as to performance or other interactions, you should feel like they give a shit in some capacity. Your coach probably is never going to care as much as you do, I wouldn't think, but it should be close, or at least time should feel like it's close. So that's my first major answer.
The athlete-coach relationship is so unique person to person. There are some really great relationships where they have very little contact.
Yep, I agree.
The coach understands the athlete. They can write them a great plan. They step away. They don't need contact. They come back when they're ready for more. And then there are those that need their hand held every day. But I'm going to say you treat it like the relationship was when it started. Mm. When you start receiving less attention than you used to have, despite wanting the same amount. It's just like dating. When they no longer give you the same attention they used to, when you are seeking that affection and it's not coming back, when they're not excited, when they're hard to get a hold of, when you're constantly waiting on your new workouts, and every time a new block gets posted or it's not posted or it's supposed to be there and you're waiting, and now the day comes up and you have to ask for it again. Like here and there, life happens. But when you start to notice the attention to you slip, it's time to address the relationship. And if it doesn't improve, you move on. And even if the relationship's fine, when you stop improving, sometimes a new pasture is needed. There are athletes that I have really enjoyed right up into the moment that they left me and they needed to leave. Even though we still had a great relationship, they just needed fresh eyes on them. And that's okay. You should get excited for yourself when your athletes do well, and you should feel nothing when they need someone else. That's the way this has to work.
You see that even, I mean, there's a lot of great endurance coaches in the professional scene. And you see top-end athletes change training groups all the time. Sometimes it's a new scenery, a new environment. Yeah. I just need something different. I just, you know, like you eat peanut butter and jelly every day, and pretty soon it's just not quite as novel and appealing, and you don't look forward to, I know what's coming, right? That often can be the case too. Just new stimulus. I've had people leave. They said, I've worked with this person, and this person. Now it's you. And I've had a handful of people do that. I'm the fourth in their list in 4 years, and that's kind of what their shtick is.
Yep.
Maybe they go back to who they like the most. Maybe they stay with you. But there's a lot of reasons. I think the other one is And it's tough because some relationships, you're right. You have to put, it's like an old friend. You have to put hardly anything in between, but you're happy. You pick up right where you left off. And if you barely contact each other, but the athlete wants their workouts and you don't need to interact much, like, great. It works on both ends. I think also, and I struggle with this as a coach, yes man versus no man, meaning like there's athletes mm-hmm. that I push back on. I got a couple right now that are trying to do everything, including like four ultras in a year. And I verbally tell them that I don't agree with their decisions. I'm not here. Yes, I work for you. I am the employee. You are the employer. But at some point, like mm-hmm. if you have a hard truth to say to somebody, you should say it. I am an encourager and a supporter, like great job all, you know, typically. And I struggle with having those harder conversations or voicing something I know they don't want to hear. But I think that's part of being a good coach. And that's part of caring and investing. Sometimes not, it doesn't need to be smooth to say you have a great relationship with your coach. It can be, and that's wonderful when it is. But like, that's always not the best coach. You hear about people telling stories of endearments of their best coach and cussing them out on the track or calling them this or doing in like a way mm-hmm. in which is productive. And so you want a positive encourager, and that's what I respond well to. But at times, like tough love or reality checks are also part of it. And if somebody's just kind of filing papers your way with another program on it, and there's no real learning along the way, like sometimes that might be a recipe for like, okay, maybe I need to be, I don't know, taught, we'll call it. So there's that aspect too, but that's just yeah. something I'm realizing as of late. Like I'm trying to be less of a yes man as a coach and a good job all the time and giving critiques along the way. So I think there's something there that balance as well.
I think so. I think that there's this stigma that the athlete leaving the coach causes a problem, and it needs to stop being that thing. Like coaches need to stop being upset with their athletes when they leave them. Kids leave the home, and they replace their mom with a spouse. That's the way this works. They replace their dad with a friend or a spouse. Mm-hmm. They leave a job and move to the next job. It didn't mean that your job was inferior. It means it no longer fits them in their current stage of life. Like you did what you did to help them get to their next level. And sometimes mm-hmm. they leave your knowledge base. They need more. Sometimes they just go in a different direction. Sometimes they need something new. It's not a personal coach. A lot of coaches like to make it personal. And I know I did early on as well, but like I'm tired of hearing coaches who send messages to their athletes. Like, I can't believe you're working with this person, or what's wrong? Like, what did I do wrong? Maybe take your ego out of it. Mm-hmm. Maybe you weren't good enough, or maybe it's not you. But it's not an internalized process here. It's on you to feel good when they do well, and it's on them, and you're happy for them when they're ready for something new. This isn't a divorce. Mm-hmm. It's just moving to the next stage of life. And so athletes shouldn't be afraid of telling their coach, I think I'd like to try something different. A good coach is going to say, can we fix that and do it here? If not, let me tell you who I think would be a good fit for you. That's how you know if you're with a good person or not. If they will actively help you find the next coach.
I'm very sad to see you go. And if you truly enjoyed working with that person, tell yeah. them that and say, I am always here to help and for questions, even though you're not paying me anymore. And if you get a response like that,
yep.
I guess maybe it'd make you second guess your decision. I don't know. But one who genuinely cares is probably going to leave that, you know, part that way. There's no drama. And if you're worried about there being drama with it, that might be your indicator right there as well. Yeah.
Right.
All right.
And is it really good? Now, there are some people who will just always want a coach, but is it really good to create dependency? Or is it a success if your athlete no longer needs you?
Okay. Really quick. Really, really quick. There's two left, and I believe in us. Okay. We're just going to do so fast.
All right.
Unless we feel
minimum
like we just
effective
can't
dose answer. Go.
John Britton says, I heard Sam Parsons with Tin Man Elite talk about a newish clean running training approach. Different than the form discussion on how you guys mentioned in the hybrid episode. Basically, it entails the only training one energy system each workout. Threshold workouts are only threshold. VO2 workouts are only VO2, etc. No mixing up quality. I don't want to knock the elite runners who are some of the best out there, but I question whether there's a training theory to back that idea up or if it just sounds alluring because it's straightforward. What's your take?
Unless I'm missing something, that's like what 99% of training programs have been for the last 100 years. It's an easy run, or it's a VO2 max, or it's a tempo run. That's it. So no, I think there's a lot of history with that, and it's good, solid science.
It's a good question. There's a YouTube video he linked as well that would be worth watching. I think it's a newer release. I do think that we get flashy and talk about Bracken and I talk a lot about different stimulus, like go for your tempo threshold run and tack on 4x400 at the end, which you could consider a different energy system. We do like to layer in stimulus, which can often be misconstrued, but generally staple type training sessions still a pure focus on one. Maybe there's a by the way just to keep one other edge of your sword sharp, but I actually think it's still pretty. You know, even look at the, as simple as the Ingebrigt style, Ingebrigtsens, who are, you know, well known for how they train. It's like threshold intervals and overspeed VO2 max session the other day of the week or 2 days. It's I think keeping it separate still is what most do, I guess. I'm backing up what you say.
Yeah, I think it's most common practice.
But it can, I mean, I understand how it can seem like there's more complexity. And you will often see in the off season, like guys doing long extended intervals or threshold stuff and then mixing in 200s at the end or doing, like, I get it. You see that. But the, what, 90% of what they do are standalone workouts focusing on certain energy systems or strides, right?
Yeah. You see it early and late, off season and sharpening.
Exactly. Todd Scholos, last one. Q&A question if you get to it. This came in this morning. As a hybrid athlete, what percentage of strength are you leaving on the table if you never do strength in isolation and instead always perform it in a circuit, Metcon, jumping on off a bike, i.e. Kirk? Potential pitfalls? And then he says, quick plug if you read it. If someone considered night school and didn't pull the trigger, it was absolutely worth it in my opinion. The info was great, but the level of interaction put it over the top. Bracken's heart is...
Thank you, Todd.
All right,
quick answer for you. You're leaving a lot of strength potential on the table if you never train it in isolation. A ton. Just from a pure maximum lifting ability, so much. Like probably like 30 to 40%. Race performance, much less. Much, much less.
I can tell you exactly what it is for me because I do it. Some of my workouts, I may hop on the assault bike and off and bench. Still doing structured stuff and then back and forth. And then some, I may just go to the gym and bro lift and bench, for example, or back squat. I can tell you if I'm on my assault bike and I'm going back and forth, keeping my heart rate aerobic, like 130s in between sets, I'll throw 185 pounds on the bar and I'll squat for 10 reps and I'm working pretty good. If I go standalone in the gym and let's say I'm doing reps of 10, maybe, you know, I'm not killing myself these days. Maybe I throw 205 to 215 on there. 205 typically, 20 more pounds with the same scheme at roughly the same RP. I could tell you, what is that, 10% or more? I'm leaving more than 10% on the table by putting up like the exact same movement into a aerobic Metcon and not. There, that's a straightforward answer. And I see roughly the same with the bench. Bench might be this 205 to 215 for eight, 215 maybe for eight, and off the bench I'm doing 185. Same thing. It's almost, they're grossly close together, but... probably 10%. That's my answer. 10% or more. Pure strength. How's that?
Like it. But remember, Hyrox is not one with a max.
Right. I don't know if it impacts your top end potential in any capacity, like you said, as far as performance when you put your running shoes on. I'm not sure.
Right. I don't think so.
Okay. I hope you, the last two questions didn't feel shorted, but we got to them all. We have a clean side of the street, Bracken. Our inbox is empty.
Well, we'll see when we sign off here how many came in while recording.
None, hopefully.
Well, you will. I'm not checking.
All right. We need to nip this thing, get it done. We got to both roll to the next phase of our days, which I believe for you is kids and me is back to the gym for clients. So thank you guys for listening. Hopefully you learned something today.
Enjoy your long run.
If anything resonated with you on today's episode and you're curious about taking your training to the next level, check out therunningpublic.com, where we have a training plan to fit your needs.